Welcome to The Rundown. I'm your host, Justin Pugliese. This podcast is dedicated to you, the run community. Each episode, we bring you interviews with top athletes and community leaders. They'll share their stories, tips, and tricks to inspire and motivate you to keep running. Ultimately, we're all just here to have fun. From elite runners to weekend warriors, find out how people get started and why they keep going. So listen up, tell your run buddies, and don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on Apple Music, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Previously on The Rundown with Val Pointer.
You know, I had goosebumps. Like, I was sweating. I was hot. I was hurting. But, like, you know, every time I, like, saw someone that I loved, it was the first time that I had that much support, you know? Usually my best friend is there, and I know she's going to be there. And I think that's always something that I look forward to, like, seeing her. I don't know when I'm going to see her. But, you know, I know she's going to be at the finish line. And I know she's going to be there for me. But, like, having all these people, it gave me so much energy.
On this episode of The Rundown, I spoke with Para Athletics Team Canada track and field star, Nate Riche. He comes from a family of gifted elite athletes. And for Nate, it wasn't any different. He excelled in baseball, and his future in the sport looked bright. But suddenly, a golf accident took that away. Nate was paralyzed on his right side, but after years of therapy, he found running. He now competes on the world stage as an 800 and 1500 meter runner. But if not for the support of his family and friends, he would not be where he is today. His words, not mine. Are you already subscribed to The Rundown, running with WRG, and still can't get enough? Sign up to our weekly newsletter and always stay connected. You can learn more about what's happening in the run community, hear about exclusive events, and stay up to date with the podcast. Visit iamarunner.ca and subscribe. Simple as that. You'll never miss a beat. In this week's news, I'd like to share an article I read on runningmagazine.ca titled, "What Can Runners Learn from a Platypus?" The article explains that a platypus is like the Swiss Army knife of the animal kingdom due to their variety of features. So what can we learn from the versatility of a platypus? Training different types of running can help develop new strength and skills you otherwise would not have had. It's also more fun to have different workouts throughout a training week. A platypus is strong because it uses all of its abilities to survive. Likewise, adding different types of training to your plan won't make you weaker, it'll just make you a better runner overall. You could run on the roads, hit the mountain trails, and even add a weekly track session as part of your training. Go become a miler, race a 10K, and maybe an ultra if you choose. Just try not to become one-dimensional. Be like the platypus and develop your own variety of abilities. With gyms and recreational centers closed these days, there's been an increase in the number of runners you see outside. If you're a runner, you're probably getting out there a little more frequently than before. So whether you're dusting off old kicks or noticing more wear and tear than usual, here are some tips for buying running shoes online. First, measure your foot. Not doing this is a common mistake and one that can lead to injury. Make sure to measure when you're standing up, and you'll want a thumbnail of space at the front of your shoe because naturally your feet will swell during the run. Secondly, read the shoe reviews. Often they'll provide valuable insight regarding the quality, fit, and any issues or potential causes for concern. And last but not least, make sure to try to find a shoe for the purpose you're looking for. A track shoe may look flashy and nice, but may not be ideal for your everyday run. Stick to what you know and wait to try different styles when the stores open back up again. Make sure to check the show notes for links and more information. That's all for now. Gotta run. My next guest competes in para athletics for Team Canada and specializes in the 800 meter and 1500 meter distances. He set world records, a couple of national titles, and even a gold medal at the Para Pan Am Games in Lima. I'd like to welcome to the show, Nate Riche.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, no problem. I know this was kind of a long time coming. I remember you reaching out to me, and typically we like to do these interviews face to face, so we're looking for an opportunity. But given the current state of the world, Le Rundown has opened up to and found a way to do these interviews remotely, and while keeping the quality at a high level. So I'm happy we get this chance to talk.
Yes, definitely. I feel the same way. I was looking forward to coming to Nationals and getting to meet you, and interview with you, but I think this is the best option that we have right now. So
exactly. So Nate, I'd usually like to start by saying, like, you've accomplished so much in your career. How were you growing up as a kid, and were you always involved in sports?
Yeah, that's really the only thing, or one of the main things I remember from my youth is sports. I remember my dad went to the Olympics in 1996. And so when I was born, my mom was still in college, and my dad was a professional athlete getting ready for the games. So, yeah, in that environment, I just basically grew up at the track, and that's kind of really all I knew.
Nice. And do you remember, like, watching your dad? And, you know, our parents are often people that we look up to. Do you remember looking at him and maybe thinking, you know, maybe that would be me one day?
Yeah, definitely. I think at first I did not want to do track because just my mom was a two-time national champion, and then my biological dad was the NCAA record holder and NCAA champion, and I think that's a lot to, you know, live up to. And so I think initially I really drew to baseball. My stepdad, who came into my life when I was two or three, he played college ball at University of Southern California, went to the College World Series and played pro ball as well. And so, he was one of the big ones I looked up to. I mean, I looked up to my mom and dad, obviously, but he was one that kind of did a different sport. And for some reason, I just gravitated towards baseball when I was young. And we're living in Arizona in 2001. The Diamondbacks won the World Series, and I got to go to Game 7. And wow. So I think just kind of being in that baseball kind of culture, as well as Phoenix is where the spring training is every summer. So we would always go watch spring training games, and a lot of my stepdad's friends were playing. And so I think that just became a passion of mine from very, 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 very early.
And was that your, you know, you took up baseball, and was that like, sounds like that was your passion. Did you see a future in baseball?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that was definitely what I wanted to do. I pitched, which was very convenient because my stepdad was a pitcher, and he was, you know, he was the number one pitcher for USC when he was in college. And yeah. And so it was really cool because I don't think a lot of times people connect with their stepdad that well. And we kind of hit it off just kind of from the start. And yeah, so it was, I had early success for sure. Had a couple strikeout records in the local little league, and I don't know, I just really enjoyed it. It was kind of like I would be outside playing for 4 or 5 hours. Okay. And just like, it wouldn't feel like work though. Like, you know, when you do something that you love, it's, you're just doing it, and then all of a sudden you look and it's time for dinner. you know, and so that's, you know, something that I found that I really enjoyed. And, you know, possibly later down the road when it kind of was taken away, I was definitely looking for that next passion.
Gotcha. Did you find that because you were surrounded with so many accomplished athletes, did it create a certain pressure for you? Or was it just fun and that's kind of how it was presented to you?
Yeah, no, I didn't feel any pressure. I think my mom, it's because of my mom, because she was so into, like, just have fun with it. You know, there's so much time to specialize and do all that. And my family's in sports medicine, so they understand the injury prevention side behind it. And so they didn't want me to take any risks when I was young. And so, yeah, it was pretty much kind of do whatever you want. The rule was you had to do a sport, had to do something, but it didn't really matter what it was.
Awesome. Well, and then how far did the baseball take you, or how far did you go with it?
Yeah, so I basically played baseball up until a couple of days before my accident. And then, my last game, I think I struck out like 14 batters. And then we were in the championship game in a couple of days, but I ended up getting injured a day or two before that. And so, yeah, so it was, it was a sport that, like I said, that I loved, but there was definitely a different plan for me.
For sure. And, so you mentioned like your injury, like this is a huge part of your story and kind of where you are today. Do you mind, maybe explaining what happened that day? And and how your life changed at that very moment?
Yeah, no, I think, it was a very life-changing moment for me. I think growing up, a lot of things came really easy to me. And when I got hit in the head by a golf ball, which ended up leaving me paralyzed on the whole right side of my body. Basically, if you just drew a line down the middle, everything on the right side was paralyzed. And when I got to the hospital, I had a couple seizures. And I think at that time, I didn't really know what was going on. I had kind of heard the word paralyzed thrown around, but at 10 years old, you don't know what that means. I remember my mom coming to me and saying that, you're going to be okay, but it's going to be really, really tough. And I think relearning how to do the things that you take for granted, like walking or being able to write. I was right-handed with everything. And I had to relearn to use my left hand for everything, which was very, 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 very tough for me. And I think the last nail in the coffin for me was when my doctor on my exit interview said, Nate, you'll never walk without a limp and you'll never play competitive sports ever again. And I think right then and there, I had to make a decision, which road do I go down? Do I go down the one of listening to my doctor's advice and just being like, and just living life without sport? Or do I possibly go down the road that's going to be a lot tougher, that I'm going to fail a lot, that I might not ever reach the pinnacle of the sport that I necessarily want? But for me, there was only one choice, and that choice was to play sports and, learn from failure at first, but then hopefully have some success down the road.
Mm. It must have been a real tough pill to swallow when you're clearly showing signs of, great ability in your sport, which was baseball at the time. And then, getting hit by a golf ball and like, sounds like a freak accident. I play golf and I'm like, that's just, oh man, it's crazy. Do you remember like when you were in the hospital, what your initial thoughts were, like your own personal thoughts on what was happening? And like, it sounds like you're a pretty positive person, but was it always that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was tough. I remember definitely having some negative bouts in the hospital with some of my the therapists and stuff, just because it's just something like walking. So, walking was so easy for me, and now it's like the my Mount Everest, so to say. And so, yeah, that was extremely tough, but. Like anything that I do, my mom is usually the one who is kicking me in the butt and challenging me, because she knows that she knows me so well, and she knows that I love a challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's something that that kind of pushes me. And so she would always throw challenges out there, like, either you can't do this, or let's see if you can do this. And luckily, she just knew me so well, and she knew exactly what to say. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was surrounded by so much family, and my support system is out of this world. And so I think if it wasn't for them, then I don't know if I would have been able to be positive. But I think my main focus was, like, I never thought I was going to play sports again. That was not the option. So I was very focused to get back on the baseball field. And then if that didn't work out, then figure something else out.
So what was the process like from that point moving forward? What steps did you need to take?
Yeah, so after I got out of the hospital, I just wanted to, get to school as quickly as I could. So about 2 days after I got out of the hospital, I went to school, kind of back in, that regular life scenario as well as I could. I was going to therapy, physical therapy, I believe it was 2 times a week, and I stayed with that for about 5 or 6 years. But I thought that the best way for me to recover was just kind of being in sport. And so I played basketball a little bit, and I would just, play at recess. And later that year is kind of when I discovered running. And I also still played baseball, because I had still one goal left. I wanted to make one more all-star team and then kind of call it quits, because I just wasn't the player that I once was. And after I started running, I kind of saw a lot of possibility in the future.
So what restrictions did you have? I know you lost the feeling in on your right side. So what kind of damage did the injury leave you with?
So I would say like my legs about at that time was probably about 50-60%.
Okay.
The strength of my left. And then my arm just didn't work. My arm and my hand didn't work at all. The fine motor skills were very bad. And they basically, and I just, they learned, they taught me how to be so good with my left hand that I just didn't even think about using my right hand. And so kind of the thing, it's like, if you don't use it, then you're kind of going to lose it. And so, so a couple of times they casted my left arm with like a removable cast to force myself to use my right arm. But that kind of just backfired on them because I just couldn't do anything at all. Because I can't carry anything. I still can't like really carry anything of weight at all with my right hand. Because my wrist is so weak and my forearm is so weak that it just kind of collapses. And my wrist just is, it's super weak. So I can't hold stuff for very long before it just collapses. During that time I used to, I dropped my lunch in the cafeteria and it went all over the place and kind of getting made fun of. And I think, when you're that age, you don't really know who you are. No one knows who they are, and kids are making fun of you, and you don't really know why, and you just think they don't understand. And so I think that time between like fifth and eighth grade was kind of a very tough time for me. I'm very thankful that I had running and a great family to kind of steer me in the right direction.
Yeah, I was going to say that could not have been easy to go back to school a couple of days later, not the same person that you were. And then, kids are mean, it's can't be an easy place to be. And also like returning to sports that you love, not the same kid. Was that also tough for you? Like how did your teammates, because team is different, right, than school. Like you got your friends at school, and was it a bit easier to return to sport? Was it more, or were the kids more understanding and more like kind in your return and supportive?
Yeah, so when I was in the hospital, my family completely moved like 90 minutes away. So I didn't play with any of the same teammates I played before I got hurt, which was good and bad, I think, because the player I was before, and then if you saw me play after, you would just not believe that was the same person.
Right.
It was really tough because I just knew no one. I think like the most embarrassing moment for me that I look back on now is I had a tryout for baseball season, and there was like the word that I was that I threw really hard, and I went, they hit the first pop fly to me in the tryout, and I caught it fine, but I went to go transfer it to my throwing arm, which I still kind of used my right arm to throw because I couldn't catch with my other hand, and right when I went to go throw, the ball fell out of my hand, and that happened like 3 or 4 times in a row. And just like kind of everyone's laughing at me, and that was kind of looking back on it, I'm happy it happened because failure is something you need to learn from, and it just really taught me that I had a lot of hard work ahead of me, and that I think anything is possible, but if you don't have the action plan to do it, then certain things aren't possible. You can't just have anything you want. And so I think that was a lesson that I learned maybe earlier than some of my teammates. Mm-hmm. But I'm now looking back, I'm super thankful that I had that lesson.
Probably, it takes a certain level of maturity too to handle that situation. I mean, I'm sure it must have been frustrating too for you as a kid when you just lose. Like, because so much of it's instinct, right? Like when you go to play baseball, this is how you would have done it. Like you're still thinking the same way, but then when you actually go to do it, that's something completely different.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I saw pitching as like kind of an art, and, I was at that time in my eyes, I was a pretty good painter, but after I got hurt, I was just horrible. The velocity was gone. I couldn't throw my changeup anymore. yeah, so there was just all the stuff that I was used to doing. And kind of, I think at that time, I identified that I am sport. Like, I'm a person who, I play sports and that's all I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at that time. And I think that's the first time with a thought more than an athlete kind of came into my mind, and thinking like, yeah, like they're sports important, but there might be some other things outside of sport that are right. extremely important to me.
What were some of those things for you?
I think initially, I was taken such good care at Phoenix Children's Hospital in Arizona. And, you know, I was kind of, I remember thinking like, wow, they have like this great hospital with all these great resources. They had a teen room where you could go play video games, and former baseball players who are rehabbing from elbow surgery from Tommy John and such, that like I would get to play video games with them. And so I felt as normal as possible as I could stay in the hospital. And later I learned that Children's Miracle Network did local fundraisers all over the state to fundraise money for better resources. And so when they asked me to speak the first time, and as I mentioned, I stuttered horribly. And public speaking was probably my biggest fear. And I did it the first time, started quite a bit, but I had so much fun. Like, I had so much fun. And I saw how I would speak at a lot of golf tournaments, because obviously my story kind of resonates. And I just, yeah, it was just something that I was so amateur at, but that's something that I could, you know, work on and kind of get better at. And so that kind of became my passion, possibly even more than running. And today I would say it's definitely more of a passion than running is for me.
Cool.
Just because I think you get to impact people and you get to also meet people. And a public speaking is probably the last thing I ever thought that I would ever do.
Well, I think it's not only scary for you, it's scary for a lot of people. I think it's high up there on the list. How long have you been doing public speaking for?
Since I was 12 years old until today.
Okay.
I think it's, I love to write as well. And that's something I did not discover till recently, but, so it's, you know, I enjoy, before I would just share my story, and now I have lessons from my story. Hopefully people can, you know, take some of those lessons and use them in their life. And, I always say if it helps one kid out, then I'm doing my job. And that's, you know, I'm not out there thinking I'm this great person. I'm just, you know, out there doing the best I can. And if I can motivate and inspire the next generation along the way, then I must be doing something right.
For sure. And that's what this podcast is all about. So again, super glad we have you. What kind of advice do you give to golfers when you're talking to them?
Yeah, I would say, make sure make sure when you're playing through that, that you stand behind the golfer, not in front of him.
There you go.
And pay attention too.
I go out there with my dad every once in a while, and, you gotta be super careful. I mean, most of the golfers out there, they're all amateurs for the most part. So yeah. Mistakes can happen. Are you still playing, or do you?
Oh, yes. Yes,
yeah,
I love golf. I will never give that up.
I'm happy it hasn't scared you off the course.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely the first time was pretty tough going back on the course. Mm-hmm. But like, I think a theme you'll learn is my stepdad is my father figure, or one of my father figures, and he's. If it wasn't for him, definitely wouldn't be anywhere near the person I am today. So I owe a lot of that getting back on the course to him. I mean, my mom definitely kept putting it in my head, but my stepdad was the one who took me out. And, I almost, there was a straight shot the first time we played. And, you know, he just taught me, like, what to do, you know, cover your head, stay focused. Like before you hit, like, look where the other holes are. So just some things that to kind of keep my mind sane on the golf course.
Yeah, be aware of your surroundings at all times, and so we can enjoy it. It's a beautiful sport, and oftentimes beautiful scenery too when we're playing. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, especially in Arizona. And
yes.
Exactly.
No doubt.
So, can you explain kind of where the love for running came in? And do you remember your first experience with with the track and running, like your own personal experience, I should say, because you did have access at a very young age, but kind of where you saw that as the next sport you could excel in.
Definitely. We had this running club at school, and basically it was like a half mile, so 800 meter loop, and every loop you got a popsicle stick. And you ran for like 30 minutes, and you know they would log the popsicle sticks. And at the end of the year, you would get this necklace with saying how much each foot like represented, like this little icon of a foot represented 5 miles, and however miles you got, that's how many feet you got. And I remember my first race. I won my first race by quite a bit, and I just remember being like, "Wow, this is fun." I remember like getting that runner's high for the first time, mm-hmm. and just being like, can I do it again? I remember asking my mom, can I do it again? Can I do it again? And just like being super motivated to train. My mom didn't let me train a lot. She just like, hey, let's just focus on the racing part. Go to practice. Just keep on enjoying this. You have your whole life to focus on being as fast as you can. And so she kind of would challenge me and say, try to do this during the race, or try to go out harder, or try to develop a kick, or things like that. And so she, I think she's the best coach I would probably say I've ever had, just because she's so good at just motivating people and knowing what bugs you and knowing what pushes you. Mm-hmm. And she would just slowly like kind of, twist that fork into me and know exactly what to say.
Nice. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, a built-in coach is always the best, right?
Definitely.
And I mean, she knows you in inside out, so I'm sure she can trigger those things and knows what makes you tick, you know? Has she like, I mean, she being a track athlete herself, did this excite her watching you kind of finding a love for the sport that she loved too?
I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but I think she definitely did. I think she saw how hard of a worker I was. And she definitely saw that this is something I love. I think she was just happy in general that there was a sport that I could somewhat excel at. Mm-hmm. And that I was definitely hampered from my injury and like so like performance. Mm-hmm. But she knew like there's such an aerobic component to it that the better aerobically I got, just the faster you're gonna be. I think I just saw a big opportunity to be successful. And I think she kind of saw my eyes light up for the first time, mm-hmm. Since I got injured. And I think that was something that I think she really liked.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's important for any like parent. I'm sure it was a really scary time for them too, you know, and as it was for yourself. And so, you know, finding a new passion, a new something that drives you that you can keep working at in sport, I'm sure was a really like, it was like a breakthrough moment for everyone. But So how did it continue for you and how did it evolve from into more from that point?
Definitely. I think one thing, you know, I ran in junior high. I won the junior high championship in eighth grade. And then I went to high school. My freshman and sophomore year, my first and second year, I was still living in Arizona, and my sophomore year I ended up breaking a couple of records from the school, but my freshman year I had a really big breakthrough. We ran the 1600 meters there, and I had kind of been running like 450 all year, and at our regional championship meet I ended up running 432. Wow. Kind of out of nowhere, but that was the first time I learned what a kick was. I think I ran sub 60 the last lap.
Wow.
And so both of my parents are explosive athletes. My mom was a pole vaulter, my dad was a javelin thrower, but my mom also ran the 4x4, and she's run 53 seconds in the quarter. And my biological dad had run 10.4 in the 100.
Wow.
So I definitely had those speed genes for sure, but I was running distance. And so I think I learned kind of my race tactic to kind of sit in the back and use as less energy as possible and just kind of slam it at the end. And I think that, you know, having to kick it's so exhilarating, at least for me. It was like, because I knew it was coming. And I just always enjoyed seeing if I could replicate a better kick than the last race. And so it kind of became a challenge for me and seeing how many people you can pass. And then, like, the better you get, the, you know, the farther up you are in the race, like early in the race, and then you can, you know, kick possibly to the lead. And so that was just kind of a game I played with myself a lot.
Nice. Well, what were some early challenges for you as a runner and with the training and the racing? Like, what do you remember some challenges that you faced early on?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just wanted to be the best, and I was very far from that. You know, there was these kids that just, when I got really tired, I couldn't use my right side. My right side would just would stop working because I have a hole in my brain. And that neurologically, sometimes it just decides not to work. And my brain would just shut down. And I also couldn't train as hard as the other kids because neurologically, the next day, I would be fried. And I would have to take 2 or 3 days off because I just can't train the same way an able-bodied athlete trains. And so I definitely, I think early on, with the help of my mom, she kind of helped come up with a program that was like, all right, we're not going to do a lot of volume, but we're going to find that quality. And I think that took a little bit to kind of find. And then luckily I moved from Arizona to Georgia, going into my third year in high school. Mm-hmm. I found a great coach, Andy Carr, and his program was very low mileage, but a lot of high quality. And so I think in cross country, I ran like 16:20 my second year. And then I ran 15:59 my third year. And then I ended up running 15:32 my last year in high school. And I think he knew so much about track. He just loved track. And he kind of, him and I kind of clicked on that. I don't think in high school I was the easiest to coach because I always wanted to do more. And I always wanted to run faster. But he did a really good job of not getting me injured. Okay. We still talk to this day. And I think, I was just a little feisty in high school. And I didn't like losing, so.
Well, you had that competitive side to you for sure from the baseball, and it sounds like how competitive you were at those sports too. So I'm sure it translated over. Were you always focused on those distances, like the, you know, you mentioned 1600, and cross country? What distance were you running in cross country? Was it a 5K,
yeah, correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
5K. I think the 800 is my love, but with just my injury and everything, some of those faster drivers just aren't there anymore. Mm-hmm. Like today, I've run 152, but you know that's not gonna get you in, especially in able-bodied races. That's not gonna get you in some of the faster heats, or sometimes not even in the meet.
Right.
I think the 1600 is kind of now what I'm built for. And the 1500 now is what I run. And so that's kind of the one I really focus on. We've been doing like a lot of longer 5K work right now, mm-hmm. Which is not my favorite, but I've seen huge benefits in it. Yeah. And my coach, Heather Henninger, she's found a programming that works so well with me. And last year was the first year that she coached me. So, but we just really hit it off. So, I'm very fortunate to have a coach in her. And I think in college, I didn't necessarily find the program that was right for me. I ended up going to Furman University in Greenville, South Carolina. And we had top 5 class in the country coming in, my freshman class.
Mm-hmm.
We had like 9 or 10 kids coming in. And by my sophomore year, I just kind of had enough. The school wasn't necessarily right for me. I still talk to one of the assistant coaches. I just don't think necessarily it was the best opportunity for me. And so I wanted to kind of see what else was out there. And there's also a small private school. And I went to, my high school was like 3,000 students.
Okay.
And my college was less than 3,000. So, and it was a private school. And yeah, it was a liberal arts school. So it just kind of didn't really fit me as well. So I transferred to South Alabama, which is right on the Alabama-Florida border by Pensacola.
Okay.
And I loved school there. I loved running there, and I loved all my teammates, and just I love communications. I love to talk. I love to connect with people. I love to just learn, really. And so that school was, you know, close to 25,000 students.
Oh,
and
yeah,
that was definitely me. I'm definitely a social guy, and I like to just like to have really good conversations, and sometimes about topics I don't know, and if, you know, someone can teach me something, you know, that's something I just really love. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, I ended up graduating in 2016 from there. I had a really good indoor season my fourth year at South Alabama, and then I ended up getting a concussion. I end up passing out at track practice and bounce my head off the sidewalk.
God.
And obviously, we have to be really conservative with my brain, with anyone's brain, but especially with someone who has, a traumatic brain injury in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And so I end up having to take a lot of times you take about 10 days off, and I took probably a little over 2.5 weeks off. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of lost my mojo and just end up finishing last in the final at the conference meet, and just had like this really bitter taste at the end of my college career. And I just wanted something more, and I had faith that it would all kind of work out. And so I just moved back home with my parents, and was helping with my siblings. I have four younger siblings, three on my mom's side. And my stepdad at that time was going through melanoma cancer. So I kind of went home, worked at the local running shoe store, and helped my mom whenever I could, and trained really hard. And then I remember she ended up writing Carla Nichols, who's paralead and for Canada, and she said, you know, there's a classification for Nate. We would love to get him classified and kind of see what he can do in the Paralympic world. And so that kind of led my journey on the Paralympic side.
Wow. Okay. And so I just want to backtrack a little. Were you on a scholarship for school with the running?
Yeah, I was on like a half scholarship at Furman, and like 75 at South Alabama, and then ended up being a full ride my last semester.
Okay.
Which was awesome. I think I'm very fortunate to, you know, be able to have that. I had a great college experience. I just didn't like the way I competed, you know. I think any of us want to be the best, and it was no one of those coaches' faults. I just wasn't that caliber of athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sometimes a tough pill to swallow. A lot of people will, you know, blame other people, but I'm the only person to blame. Mm-hmm. So
were you racing against able-bodied kids?
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so that both of them were D1 schools. So
okay, yeah. So I mean, like that's a challenge. So when you came back, did you make that a mission of yours to get back to as close to full health as you could, so you were able to compete with the able-bodied kids? Was that a goal for you? Like, okay, I want to get back to, you know, I don't want to. Like, is that all you knew was racing against those kids and did your best to kind of keep up with them?
Definitely. Yeah. Like I only, that's all I knew. That's my mom kind of threw me into able-bodied racing right away. And so that's kind of all I knew. And no one really knew about my injury. Not a lot of people knew about it unless they would ask me. But like my injury, like you can see it as a disadvantage. You can look at it as an advantage, right? As a disadvantage, like I can't recover as fast. My body doesn't move as efficiently as they do. But I do have to do the little small things that they might not do to be able to race equal with them or close to them. And so when I came to the Paralympic side, I already did all those small things. And so I think that's, you know, why I had a lot of success initially, was just because I already did all those little things. I knew how to be in a high performance environment because that's basically what I grew up in. I'm thankful for all the failures I had and getting my butt whooped and getting like 200th place in a cross country race and being like, dang, I just PB'd and I got smoked.
yeah, right?
And so I remember being at pre-nats and this race, like Edward Cheserek is in this race. And I remember we hit the mile in like 4:46. And so that's like probably a sub 3 minute K. And I'm in like 310th. And I'm like way under my PB pace. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, I can't even, like, I can see the leader like 500 meters, like cresting the hill. And I was like, seriously, I'm getting smoked this bad this early in the race? I was like, you have to be kidding me. So yeah, I definitely learned. Definitely learned quick.
No kidding. Yeah, it's there's a lot of things to learn, I'm sure. Well, in racing, the more you do it, the better you're able to prepare, the better you're able to strategize for races and stuff like that. Like you said, like in track, like the kick is key, you know. A lot of the times it comes down to that when you're watching these world games and stuff, which you've now participated in. You know, some of these races come down to that, really. And it's also what makes these races so very exciting too at the same time, you know. So I just wanted to ask you about that. So then your mom kind of opened up this world of para athletics for you, right? And you were talking also about the little things. So what were the little things that you were doing before you even got there that kind of gave you a head start?
Yeah, like even in high school, like I some of my buddies would go and party and things like that. Like I never drank really until I was 22 years old, which I thought that was one thing that would help you recover faster. I slept. I would go to bed at 9 p.m. every night. I would do 2.5 hours of corrective program every day. And so those are like the three, and then eat really well. And that's unfortunate also that I have family that knows exactly what to do. Mm-hmm. My uncle Trevor, he worked with Kobe Bryant, he worked with Blake Griffin, Kemba Walker. And so he does their, injury prevention program. He does their treatment and he does their lifting. And so I have a guy who works with the best athletes in the world.
Yeah. They're not bad. Those athletes.
Designing my programs. Yeah. I mean, if you go look at Kobe Bryant's documentary, my uncle's the one who's doing treatment on him in all the videos.
Very cool.
And so, yeah, my uncle, yeah, he's been, you know, he's the reason why, I've run this. One of the big reasons why I've run as fast as I have is because my body doesn't work like other people's does. And he tries to put me back together. And, we come out with a program where we know lifting wise, what I can and what I can't do. And so it's more just trying to stay, trying to keep me healthy and keep that stability. Cause I lose that stability as it goes on. And then your foot starts to going out and then that causes your hamstring to shorten. And then all of a sudden that's just the kinetic chain just screws everything up and then you're injured.
Right.
He's worked with me since I was 11 years old. So he has a lot of experience and he knows exactly. There's no guesswork behind it. It's all objective measuring. And so yeah, super fortunate.
Amazing team behind you, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. Like I had a quote from Worlds said that my inner circle deserves 99% of the credit, and I deserve 1% of the credit. And that's honestly how I feel. I love doing the work. I love practice. I'm that crazy person who just loves to train. There's a lot of people who just love the race, and like some of the training isn't as fun, but training is my favorite. I think I run for many reasons, but one of it is that kind of that mental stimulation and like really challenging yourself. And I love getting challenged. Mm-hmm. And that definitely roots in for my injury when they said I could never would walk again or without a limp or play competitive sports. And I just remember thinking like, you don't know me, mm-hmm. but I will definitely show you that I'm going to prove you wrong.
Yeah. It's all in the, you know, preparation and the determination. And if you look at any successful athlete, I'm sure your uncle probably has a bunch of stories from the athletes he's worked with.
Yeah, and it's really cool. Like. He played rugby on the international stage in New Zealand as well. So he was a professional athlete himself, so he understands it too, which is nice to have from the therapist.
Mm-hmm. Did he share any stories with you from any of these legends? Like, I mean, Kobe Bryant's as legendary as they get, but.
Definitely, yeah. I think I think Kobe made him wake up pretty early a couple times. I've been super fortunate to become pretty good friends with Blake Griffin.
Okay.
I've been able to hang out with him, and he's it's crazy when I would go over his house for my uncle to treat him, and he's asking about my world championships, and he's asking, "Hey, I saw you ran this." Like it's pretty crazy when someone, you know, we see in pop culture is like kind of the man, and he had like a year ago, he had this best season he's ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is asking me about how my season went. And, you know, we will message every once in a while, and he's always, he's always awesome to me. And at last year at Nationals, he had a comedy tour in Montreal the same weekend my race was.
Okay.
And so I got to go have dinner, or I got to go have breakfast with my best friend, Ty, Blake, my uncle, and Blake's brother. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he's just, he's probably one of the best character-wise athletes I've ever met, and just such a down-to-earth guy. And, I just feel lucky that he's, been nice enough to kind of share some of his wisdom kind of on how he got to where he is today.
Yeah. I mean, getting to touch that is, it's always a good thing, you know. It's like, gives you some insight into what they do and how they get there. So I'm sure it's inspired you, through your career. Can we kind of move to the Paralympic side of it and, be getting on Team Canada and what that looked like for you, you know, out of school and how that was different for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was living in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And it was Christmas 2017. I decided to move to Phoenix because I thought that, I think I needed to kind of find my own way. And, the weather was a lot better too. In Georgia, the weather is like, especially during the winter, like you pretty much have to bring every clothes you could ever think of, because it could be like 25 degrees on Monday. It could be a flash flood on Tuesday, and it could be snowing on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of never know. And it's just hard to plan. Like when you're doing speed work, and I have a bad left hamstring because I overcompensate on that side, and I would just pull it. And so I'm just wasn't getting the proper training in, so I decided to make the move to Arizona. And I was there for about 8 months, and I ended up getting classified early in 2018. I think it was in like April in 2018. And then I ended up setting some Carla Nichols, who's the para lead, invited me to go to a meet in Berlin, Germany. And I set both of the world records in the 8 and the 15 back-to-back days. And that's kind of when I was like, oh, geez, this is a little bit different. because in college, I never had like any media want to talk to me or anything. And then all of a sudden, I mean, we flew straight from Berlin, straight to Nationals.
Wow.
And so like obviously there's a couple media outlets that wanted to interview me in Ottawa. And so yeah, it was just like it almost was like I was in the dark, and then all of a sudden all the bright lights got turned on, and I came out of nowhere. And that's kind of how it is in the Paralympic dream, you know. There's sometimes people get classified, and all of a sudden they're just smashing records. And so yeah, I kind of came out of nowhere, and it was a very interesting experience, because I never really did any interviews, and so it was I got definitely a crash course. And thank goodness I had Carlo behind me. And then then later that year I would start being coached by Heather Henninger, and she She understands how big character is for me, and taught me a lot about interviewing, as well as my agent Taylor. So yeah, I think it took a whole team to really teach me how to, you know, deal with all this new media that I was, I was dealing with.
So when you say classified, that means you're put on the team. Is that?
So I get, so you get your international classification, which is basically you go through a battery of tests, and to see if you're allowed to be in the Paralympics or not, like see if you fit within the category.
Okay.
So I got that done. And when you get your international classification, that means you can compete in Pan Ams and Paralympics and World Championships if your country selects you. And so that was the big hurdle that I had to go to be able to compete.
And so you're facing, like in your case, you're facing a level of paralysis. What are some other of the athletes facing it within that category?
Yeah, so it's basically CP and TBI is what the classification is. And so there's, so 37 and 38, I'm a T38. So 37 and 38 race against each other. And they took away the 800 in our classification. And they didn't tell us the reasoning, but I think they want to make it more competitive so that you either have to run the 4 or the 15, so that the 8 kind of was making the competition not as deep. So pretty much everyone either has a traumatic brain injury or just was born with CP or somehow got it throughout life.
Okay, gotcha. So when you got to Berlin and you crushed the record, did you realize that that was your potential? Did you have any idea that that's what you were primed to do at that moment, or did it come as a complete shock?
Confidently I knew I could do it. I remember calling my mom the night before and just being like, oh, like I'm so nervous. Like there wasn't expectation I think I was putting it on myself. But I was like, everyone expects me to break this one world record because my PB was like just under it. And they expect me to break this world record. And like, I don't know, I was just really nervous. Like if I break it, then there could be me. I was just like freaking out. And I was definitely jet lagged still. So I'm sure that didn't help the conversation.
Right.
And my mom just said, Nate, you deserve to be where you're at. And it's not your fault that you're fast. It's not your fault that you've worked really hard. I saw all that work that you put in. Now go do what you want to do. And so that just kind of silenced my mind, and I knew exactly what I had to do.
Nice. And that's hell of a performance overseas. And then, like you said, they flew you to nationals. And so did everything kind of go very quickly after that? Like you mentioned having to deal with like media now and then interviews and all this new stuff. How did you handle that? Like personally, I know you said you had a good team around you, but, can't help but think it's probably a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, it definitely was pretty overwhelming at first. And, I started working with a sports psychologist pretty shortly after. And him and I created this thing called the Grey Wolf mentality, which is kind of like the Mamba mentality, but it's the things that I believe in, the things that have gotten me to where I am. And I think during these interviews, I wanted to be like super direct with who I am. I don't want people to have to guess who I am or what I stand for. Mm-hmm. And Grey Wolf comes from, that's my middle name, is Grey Wolf. So, I've always loved my Native American heritage. And so it kind of just put everything together in a couple words.
Cool. That's a pretty badass middle name.
yeah, definitely. And I can expand on that more if
yeah, definitely. I definitely want to hear about it.
Yeah, so it's broken down into six pillars, which is relentlessness, giving back, attention to detail, lean into adversity, isolation, and failure. So the isolation and failure are just and leaning into adversity are things that have made me into the person I am today. I think, you know, running, you're by yourself a lot, or if you're in the mountains, altitude training, I think you learn a lot of about yourself. So those were three really important pillars for me. Relentlessness is just, I think that was fostered after my injury, because everyone kept telling me no and I kept saying yes. And so that's something where, you know, people may tell you that you can't do something or that you won't do something. But I think if you can focus on, you know, that daily task, not too worried about, you know, that end goal, and focus and be in the present and just work your butt off. And then a lot of times, you know, you can take for instance, now, like, the Paralympics are 18 months away. And it's like, it's how do you plan for 18 months? But I just plan for every day being the best athlete that I possibly can be and getting in the work every day and enjoying it. And then the last two are giving back and attention to detail. And I would say giving back is probably the most important thing to me, because people gave to me. And if I, and then the generation before me, allowed the opportunities for the Paralympic opportunities I have now, they helped those opportunities be there for me. And so I just want to do the same thing for the next generation, and hopefully I can motivate and inspire them in some small way.
That's incredible, Nate. I love that. That's awesome. I think everybody should kind of have a breakdown of some sort, you know, like that, to kind of define themselves. Do you find that, like, yeah, like you said, you don't want to confuse people and when you're explaining who you are, you know, this is like, you know, this is who you are. And it's a great way to be, or a great thing to have.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Hey, no problem. So like after that, like moving forward, like what were some of your highlights? I mean, I know what the highlights are, like, you know, you won gold and you set a couple of national records. How did that look for you? And like, did you ever imagine that you were going to be able to do those things?
Yeah. I definitely believed in myself. But it's like, it's so funny how you can be so confident and then you're on the line and you're like, oh my gosh, we're really about to do this. And so, yeah, it can be like very overwhelming. I think everyone saw my last season and being like, oh, you probably like had the best season like of all time, and like you like had so much fun. And yeah, I had a lot of fun, but there was a lot of down during that season as well. I broke up with a girlfriend right before Worlds that we've been dating for 15 months, and you know, I was pretty messed up going into Worlds. And you know, I was in a new place. I was living in Victoria. I had moved up from Arizona. I only have one relative in Canada. All new coaches, all new teammates, didn't know anyone in BC. And so, yeah, I think it was a learning curve for sure last year. Yes, the highlights were that I won Worlds and I won Pan Ams. It definitely, I had a lot of personal growth. And I think looking back on last year, I'm super happy I went through everything I went through, because it just got me ready for, you know, this year. And this year has already been pretty crazy with everything that's going on. And that last year was, I think everyone, like I said, just looks at it and thinks that it was like a dream year, but it was definitely a very challenging year for me.
Yeah. And like you said, you know, you're putting in the work too. Behind every athlete, I'm sure there's those downs too. We see a lot of the time through social media, all the ups, or most of the time, all the ups, unless these particular athletes are willing to share the downs too. Like, has coming into this season off such a high, and now we're dealing with this this world pandemic and all the cancellations, how has that affected you at this point?
Yeah, definitely. So it's I was super fortunate after Worlds. I got to travel for like 6 weeks. So I went to London, England to see one of my uncles, and I went to California. Then I went to Georgia to see my parents. And then I ended up getting to go to Boston to go watch Kemba Walker play basketball with my uncle Trevor. And then we had another training camp in Phoenix. So I got to kind of travel, and honestly, for 2 weeks, I didn't even think about running. And I think the biggest thing for me is that, like, physically, I'm usually pretty good during the season because I do all the stuff to recover. But mentally, I get pretty fried because there is a sense of pressure, you know, to be the favorite going into the World Championships. I think that break was super, super important. This year, I think the first 48 hours when I heard about the coronavirus, I almost was broken. I remember staring at the wall and having this like tingly numbness sensation and just being like I didn't race indoors because I was setting myself up for the outdoor season to, you know, peak right at the Paralympics. I think, you know, sometimes you can be negative at first. But then I sat down and kind of reflected on everything. And, you know, I think the silver lining for me is I can only control what I can control. And there's been some, you know, some great people who have kind of come into my life recently that, you know, have been extremely helpful during this time. And when I moved out to Victoria, I met Ty, and he's one of my best friends now. And so we're always talking and, you know, he's been a huge help. And I just have, like I said, I just have such a great support staff. And I remember after the news broke, I think I was on the phone for like 3 or 4 hours with like eight different people checking in with me. I'm just super, super lucky to have those great people in my corner. But at the same time, there is going to be a Paralympics and I'm going to be ready. So I'm just focusing on this time to get ready, but the training right now is the less stressful part of my day. I'm not worried about hitting times. I, you know, put my watch on the other side of my wrist, or I don't even see the pace or the times. You know, I'm just going off feel. And so I'm just having a lot of fun.
Awesome. And what does training look like for you for those distances that you're focused on?
Yeah. So like a typical week for me, usually Mondays are always off. Fully off. I believe in taking a day off every week. And then Tuesday is usually our big workout day, or one of our big workout days. So a lot of times on Tuesday, we'll have like a aerobic session. So that can look anywhere from like 30 minutes of anaerobic threshold to sometimes coach likes to break it up into like 5 minute efforts. So it can be like 5 times 5 minutes or 6 times 5 minutes. And in the 1500, it's so aerobic. That's, you know, super important. And then on a Wednesday is a double run with a lift in the morning. A Thursday is a longer run in the morning, in the afternoon off with usually some form of strides. Friday is another double run with a lift. Saturday is usually a big workout on the track. And then Sunday is your long run. And so that's kind of what the week looks like. And we kind of go on cycles where we have intensity week, a volume week, and a recovery week. And so those are the cycles that we go through. And my mileage is, last year it was really low. It was like 60 to 70K. This year I've been running about 100K because I wanted to, I knew that the 5K aerobic stuff is my weakness. And so I wanted to tackle that so that I can be more of a front runner instead of sitting back and kicking, because I want to make Paralympic races a little bit more exciting and run as fast as we can and go out and kind of take the pace. And so that's kind of something, I look at it as a painter, you know, it's something that wasn't in my palette that I want to bring to my palette. And so that's just something I've been really working on. And, you know, during this time, it's a great time to work on something that you're not as good as the other things.
For sure. Hey, so yeah, you were an artist as a pitcher, and now you're an artist as a runner.
Yep. Definitely.
That's awesome. I love that analogy. It's great. We can always, you know, add tools to our toolbox, you know?
Definitely. And my mind's a little crazy too. So like I say colors when I race, like different colors mean different things. And when I'm sprinting all out, it's white, or when I'm about to kind of pinch it to really kick, it's red. And so my coach, Jeff Harris, who was an Olympian in the 800, he kind of brought that to my attention, and it's been super helpful.
Yeah, those triggers are key, right? It's what do you relate to be able to trigger these emotions, or I did a live with Tasha Wodak yesterday, and we're talking about her coach and the thing she tells her to focus on in training that translates to the races afterwards, you know, like focus on your arms or focus on your legs or, you know, quick strides, like these little cues. But I guess for everybody, it's a little bit different. So
definitely. Yeah.
That's really cool. And I'm always interested too in the mileage too. And you said 100K a week. That's pretty interesting. Like, cause like I focus more on the marathon, right? But I find for runners, like the mileage, like my mileage probably get up, you know, and when I'm training is back, you know, back to like 120, 140 traditionally is what it's gone to. But even for short distance runners, they're still doing the 100K a week, or, you know, you were doing 60, 70 at one time. But I find it interesting. The volume always remains. I guess it's just the specificity of the workouts that's a little bit different.
Yeah, definitely. I always say like middle distance runners have to be decent at everything. You know, they have to be good at the sprinting. They have to be able to do plyos. They have to be good at the strength work. You know, some athletes are, you know, one way on the spectrum. But I'm kind of right in the middle. So I kind of really have to work on all of those things because I'm not great aerobically and I'm not great sprinting wise. And so I have to really rely on that aerobic system, and then hopefully my speed can help me out a little bit at the end.
For sure. What would you say, Nate, is your greatest accomplishment at this stage?
It's hard to say because, like I said before, I'm like more than an athlete. I see myself as more than an athlete. And, most people would say on the track is probably winning a world title. But I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is chasing my dream of becoming Paralympic champion, because my favorite thing in the world is being an older brother to my four siblings, who are all younger than me. And, you know, I think they look up to me at some point. And if I show them that I'm chasing my dreams, then they can go chase theirs. Because if I'm telling them to go chase their dreams, but I'm not doing mine, then I have no room to talk. I've always been someone who likes to lead by action. And so I think looking back, that's probably the thing that I'm most proud of.
Awesome. And do they also follow in sport as well as most of your family has?
Definitely. I think I might be one of the worst athletes out of the five of us. So my siblings are all fantastic athletes. My sister Avery is the best athlete in my opinion. She's the youngest. But my brother Max, he runs and plays golf. He's 14 and he's 6'4".
Wow. Jeez.
My brother Benji is actually a very good pitcher in baseball. And so I think I love watching Benji play baseball. It kind of takes me back a little bit. Mm-hmm. You kind of just see me kind of with a huge smile on my face. And, I'm excited for all of them, you know, kind of what's going to be in the future for them. But at the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter to me if they play sports or not. I just hope they do something that they're passionate about. And so it feels like they're never working a day in their life.
Right. What's the thing you're looking forward to the most once this coronavirus is over?
Obviously racing would be awesome, but I'm looking forward to taking some off time, going to see some people, hopefully can do some off time in Vancouver and, be able to just kind of, like I said, I love track and field, but I do love my downtime and I do love to, you know, just hang out and be a normal person for a little bit as well. And so I'm definitely looking forward to kind of both of those things. And I'm hoping to see some family here soon as well. You know, I've been FaceTiming my siblings a lot and they're very bored not being able to play sports. So I'm really hoping that I'll be able to go see them play sports here in the near future. Because that's definitely, as an older brother, that's probably one of my favorite things is, you know, watching them do something that they really enjoy and that they're excelling at. It's definitely very fun.
For sure. Yeah, it's a fun family activity too. And it's nice that you guys all support each other in your individual sports. So that's great.
Definitely.
You also spoke about like nutrition as well a little bit. Can we touch on that and like what do you eat?
Yeah, definitely. I'm like in the mornings, I'm definitely a big oatmeal guy. For sure. I just kind of have a loaded oatmeal bowl in the morning. I think one of the most important things is getting that snack in 30 minutes after your workout. Right now I am just kind of a Clif bar, a banana, and some chocolate milk is my go-to post-workout snack. I'm usually for lunch, I'm pretty simple. So I do a lot of rice and chicken, a lot of sweet potatoes and chicken. I try to eat steak like once a week, as well as a fish once a week. And I'm a little bit of a, I guess, bigger distance runner. Like I'm sometimes I weigh up to like 175 pounds during the off season. And so we learned that like pasta the night before really big workouts is good for me. Just because I need to eat so much carbs. And I'm just kind of a bigger, you know, my genetics are more speed based from my parents. Mm. And so I have a little bit different, vehicle, as they like to explain it as, you know, under the hood, it's a little bit different than your typical 1500 meter runner. I just got to make sure that I'm fueled, because it's like some athletes run well on more like a little bit more of an empty stomach. I like to be completely full. Like if I'm hungry at all, it seems like negative thoughts go flooding to my brain. And so I really have to make sure that I'm fueled properly.
Okay, nice. Yeah. that's a well-balanced diet, I got to say.
Yeah. and I guess some vegetables every once in a while.
Yeah, veggies are good too. I'm vegan, so yeah, veggies is a bulk of my diet, 100%. Gotcha. How do you, you mentioned negative thoughts there. How do you deal with negative thoughts and or stay in a good positive mental state when things aren't going so well?
Definitely. I think there's a couple things I do. I think mindfulness is something I found when I started working with John, who's my sports psych. That's something that's really, that's been a huge benefit, because I'm definitely naturally, I think my coach will tell you this, I'm a very fiery person. I'm extremely competitive. And so we figured out that I don't need to get more pumped up before a race. I need to actually relax and be like super calm. Like before Worlds, I was dancing before I went into the call tent. we just learned that, yeah, I just need to calm down. I think another thing is putting things into perspective. That's been a big thing for me. Like if I have a bad workout, like in the grand scheme thing of things in the world, a bad workout is like laughable, right? Like it's right. Like there's so many more things going on in the world, and like for you to be super PO'd about a bad workout, come on, like get over yourself. Like you're allowed to feel bad for 3 or 4 minutes, but like don't carry that into the rest of your life or the rest of your day. And so that's one thing that I wasn't great about 2 years ago and that I'm way better at now. And so I think I just try to take that more than an athlete tagline in just my daily life.
Yeah, that's awesome. Some good lessons there for sure. What are some things that I have a question about, because I know you're dual citizen, right?
And correct.
So you could technically race as an American or as a Canadian?
Yes, correct.
So how did you end up on the Canadian side?
Yeah, I think there's three things that really swayed me. Number one, my mom. She won the Olympic trials in the pole vault, but never made the Olympic team. Athletics Canada back then was under different leadership. I felt like she should have made the team, and so I kind of wanted to right a wrong. And my mom did everything for me. She's the one who drove me to all my treatments and all that. So it was kind of a thank you and a respect thing. And my mom's mom died of breast cancer when she was 50 and I was like 3 or 4 years old. And she was, everyone talked about how fantastic she was. And I wanted to do as a respect thing to her to run for Canada. And also my grandpa, Jim Harrison, who played in the NHL for 8 years or 10 years. He played with the Maple Leafs. He played with Wayne Gretzky. He played with Bobby Orr. He had a record for the most points in a game at one time, had 10 points in one game and 3 goals in 21 seconds.
Wow.
And so his pride for Canada is something that I aspire to, to have. And he loves Canada so much. And I just saw his pride for the flag, and seeing that in my family, it was a pretty easy decision to make after kind of talking to him about it.
Amazing. So you wear that flag pretty heavily, I'd say.
Yes, definitely. There's, I remember when the flag went up after I won Worlds and the anthem was playing, and it's really hard to not get emotional. There's a lot of people who have made sacrifices, for me to do this running thing. And I think it just all kind of came out. And, I'm not someone who's super emotional, but you could probably definitely see me teary eyed. And I wouldn't want to run for any other country.
Amazing. Well, we're lucky to have you anyway. So
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. What would you say to somebody who is facing something that like you went through, and mm-hmm. and what would you tell them? What advice would you give them?
Yeah. I think number one, I think it's really important to have a plan of some sort, have some sort of action plan. It doesn't matter if it's like a small goal, but have some milestones that you're working on to get to that big goal. For instance, like for me, it was to dress myself by myself, firstly, because I had trouble doing that, or it was to walk down the hallway, or it was to be able to, I stuttered really bad and I was really nervous to be able to call and ask for room service and get a chocolate shake, or to be able to walk all the way to the teen room and play video games. Or, I think that's super important, and to understand that we all think that life is this flat road that you're just going to go straight to success. But, people who are older, will always tell us that it's, very windy. And I think that can be more than true. There's going to be these speed bumps, and there's going to be, you're going to take some wrong turns, and just have faith that everything's going to work out, and just, keep working hard. And I think stay true to yourself, because as I always say, I would rather finish last place at the Paralympics and have character than finish first with no character. And so I think really defining what's important to you, as I did in my Grey Wolf mentality, is super important, because then you know exactly who you are. You're not guessing who you are.
Amazing. Well, thanks for sharing that, Nate. That's good advice for sure. Are you doing this full time? Running is
correct.
That's awesome. What a gift that is, eh?
Definitely. Yeah. I was working when I lived in Georgia, and just, it was just really tough. I'm sure athletes who work understand this, is just that it's tough for, especially an athlete who doesn't recover very well, being on your feet in the running store, like 20 or 25 hours a week. For me, it was tough. I just wasn't able to recover as well. Looking back, I'm super thankful that I did work, because I have an amazing relationship with Joe, who owns Fleet Feet in Georgia. And so I'm super, super thankful for that. But I'm lucky that, I'm supported by Athletics Canada or Sport Canada, able to kind of live off that. And I'm super fortunate. And I think I won't be running past 2024. And so that's when I'll retire and hang my spikes up. And so I'm just trying to get the most out of this opportunity.
Oh, you're looking that far ahead, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think everything for me is planned, and nice. I like to, or loosely planned, right? Like we didn't plan to be quarantined for multiple months.
Yeah.
But no, I think I saw some of my family members kind of, go too long in the sport. Mm. And I do have many interests outside of sport. And so I really want to go chase those interests and make an impact. And I want to have my own brain injury foundation, have a golf tournament associated with it, and possibly create a scholarship to give para athletes so that they can train full time, like I currently do. And so I think there's a lot of things where like running is great, but I think there's other areas where I can make an impact and help the next generation, which my ultimate goal is to help further the Paralympic movement in any way I can. And that might not be running, that might be being behind the scenes.
Well, that's great. Like, I love hearing that. And you, like you said, it's not your only passion and that running isn't the only thing you do. So it's good to have a plan B. And I'm sure having those athletes in your family too, you can see that it's important to have something after the fact. And so it sounds like you have a pretty good roadmap ahead of you. What are you involved with any organizations now that support para athletics or anything like that?
So I do a lot of stuff with Canadian Paralympic Committee. I do a lot of speeches at kind of some fundraising events, and I've kind of gotten sick of us not having money for development programs. So me and my uncle were putting on a fundraising event this year in Detroit, because that's one of the places where his company is based. But it ended up getting canceled because of obviously the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to try to redo that next year and hopefully bring it up to Victoria and make it annually thing, because I think it's sometimes hard to look at like Brent Lakatos, who's, in my opinion, the best wheelchair athlete of all time. And you see Brent winning multiple gold medals, but then you're discouraged because you don't know how you get there and there's no development programs to get you there. And sure, there's a couple in place, but there's not ones that kind of define that road. And that is something, especially post competition, that I'm definitely going to be trying to help.
Awesome. What's the number one objective for you in running right now? Like what are you chasing?
I think it's definitely the gold medal is something that I guess I'm chasing, but I think I've found something that I'm super passionate about and I'm just having so much fun. So I think along this journey I've met so many fantastic people who have impacted my life beyond words. And so I'm just going down this path, and I have faith that this is the path I'm supposed to be going down. But you know, if something happens and I need to adapt, I'm also ready for that. Like if running was done for me tomorrow, I think at first it'd be a hard pill to swallow, but I would be fine with living my life and figuring something else to do, because as it happened with baseball with me. And I think I'm just super fortunate for the opportunities I've been given, because I understand that not everyone has the opportunities that I have, or, has the family that supports me through pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And so I think, I think that's kind of what I'm chasing.
Yeah. You're no stranger to adversity. That's for sure.
Yeah.
what does running mean to you?
Running saved me, I would have to say. Running is it's definitely layered. It runs deep. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have an outlet like running something I'm going to do for the rest of my life. It allows me to clear my mind. And I think it's funny because, like I said, the doctor said I would never walk again. And now I'm a professional athlete running. And that's my job right now. I just love it. And like I said, the mental side is I have to be challenged, and running, you get to challenge yourself on a daily basis, if not on a daily basis, definitely on a weekly basis. I love when you're doing a workout and it's really hard, like you're doing 12 times 400 off a minute or 90 seconds, and you're running goal 500 meter race pace, and you get like nine done and you feel like you can't do any, And you're like, well, I feel like I can't do any more, but we're going to find out if I can do any more. And I love, like, when I got hurt and I had to decide what road to go down. I think you learn so much about yourself. And I love that personal growth part of running.
For sure. Have you had a conversation with that doctor since?
I have not. He's one of my best friend. That's a woman, Erin. She's like, Dr. Kaplan is like a father figure to her. Him and I haven't talked about that conversation. But I think I definitely, every time they're together, they always send me a picture and say hi. So I think he's very happy for me. And I think at some point he deserves some credit. You know, it's, you know, maybe that's when I was younger, I would never imagine me saying those words. But he created this chip on my shoulder saying that, you know, I'm going to do the work. I'm going to put all the work in. And I never cheated the process. And that's one thing that, you know, he taught me, because I want to get, and I want to be elite, and I want to be high performance athlete. And, you know, I really needed to follow the process. And luckily I had some parents that knew exactly what to do, and they led me down that path.
Well, Nate, your story is nothing short of inspiring. And it's like, there's so many things that we touched on that kind of brought you to this point. And, you know, the process and the journey is definitely part of it. For all athletes that want to get there, but you were definitely faced with it, a challenge that most of us haven't had to face. And it's just it's incredible what you've been able to overcome and where you've gotten to today.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I think, you know, it always goes back to my team, and I know I wouldn't be the person I am today without them. But yeah, no, it's been a journey. And, you know, looking back, my brain injury, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. In the moment, you never say that with adversity. You always think it's the worst thing happening, but I think perspective in hindsight is some of the best things. And I'm just super fortunate for my journey, and I definitely wouldn't change it.
Amazing. Well, we're fortunate to have had you on the show finally. We wish you all the best for the remainder of 2020. Hopefully we get some races in before you're able to start preparing for the Olympics in 2021.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on, and I hope you and your family are staying safe, and I'm sure we'll be in contact in the next couple of months, and hopefully you can get some races in too.
I hope so. Supposed to have Berlin in September, so we'll see. Gotcha. How that goes.
Yes, for sure.
Take care, Nate. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
No problem. Bye-bye. This episode is brought to you by the WRG Run Club. What's really good is running with people who are fun, friendly, and positive. But seeing as we can't do that in person right now, let's try our best to stay connected through social media. How can you do that? Every Monday, we'll connect through a virtual run. You can go out there at any time of the day and run any distance you choose. When you get home, share your run with us on Instagram by tagging at WRGRuns, and we'll post it in our stories for everyone to see. It's a tough time for everyone, so hopefully this helps us stay motivated to get out there and keep moving. If you want to learn more, visit our website, imarunner.ca, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. Hope to see you all soon. Thank you for joining us on this episode of The Rundown. We hope you enjoyed our show. Please make sure to visit us at imarunner.ca. You can also let us know what you think and follow us on Instagram at The Rundown. Now take what you've learned and run with it.
The Rundown is a production by WRG Media, recorded in the historic RCA building in St. Henry, Montreal. Produced and recorded by Forrest McKay. Our executive producers, Leslie and Lindsay Woods. Graphics and illustrations created by Ryan Bondi, and hosted by Justin Pugliese.